Hi, this is Ken Ham, President and CEO of Answers in Genesis, and I have with me today a very special guest, Dr. Andrew Snelling. He's a creation scientist from Australia. Welcome, Dr. Snelling.
Thank you, Ken.
Andrew, I think the first time I met you was, I'm thinking back, 25-odd years ago when I travelled down to Sydney. We were just starting the creation ministry in Queensland, Australia, and I met up with you, I think, at the home of a doctor, actually, if I remember, in Sydney.
That's right. It was Phil West, and it must have been 1976 or 1977, somewhere in around there.
So seems like millions of years ago,
doesn't it? Yeah, it is. We feel like it is, too.
Now, at that stage, you were studying for your PhD, I recall.
That's right. At the University of Sydney, I was doing a PhD in geology.
And When I met you, you were a young earth creationist, but let's go back before that. Mm-hmm. When did you first get interested in the topic of creation? Have you, did you grow up in a Christian home? When did you give your life to Christ? Yep. Explain a bit about your testimony
there.
Yes,
well, I grew up in a Christian home, and we went to a Bible-believing church where we were taught in the scriptures right from early age. And I, sat through church as a wriggling 4- and 5-year-old. And that was a great time, but it was when I was 8 that I went away with my older brother to a holiday camp. And it was that time where I was personally challenged. And I know on the Friday night, the last night of the camp, when we had a fun night, but also a serious gospel presentation, that I talked to my dorm leader, who was a Bible college student training. He was a trainee pastor, and he led me to the Lord in my own prayer of confession. And he discipled me for a little while longer and told the folks back at my church. And so that's where it was. I made a definite commitment, even though I'd been born into a Christian home. It wasn't my parents' faith. It was my faith. And it I look back, and it's no coincidence at all. It's in God's plan as I see it. And I saw it very soon, actually, very quickly. A year later, we went on a family vacation to Tasmania, which is Australia's island state to the south. A beautiful, beautiful area. And we went to Western Tasmania, where there's some old mines. Well, actually, there's a copper gold mine that's still operating around Queenstown. And my parents knew someone there, and we were able to get a visit to the mines. And, of course, I got fascinated by all the coloured rocks, and so I started picking up rocks. And so at 9, I began my interest in geology, and I talked about it back at school and started collecting crystals and rocks, and my parents encouraged me with this hobby, but it became more than a hobby very quickly, so that by the time I got to high school, I was convinced I was going to be a geologist. To everyone's amazement. But, of course, I look back at now and see that that was God's hand. And that led me to start asking questions about what I was reading in the textbooks. In fact, I used to annoy the librarian at high school. I used to go into the library at lunchtime instead of being out with my buddies in the playground. I'd pull out this huge, thick book on geology, and I'd sit there reading it in the lunch hour. And the librarian would say, go on, put that away. Go out and have play. Well, I fixed up the librarian. At the end of my first year in high school, I won some prizes for academic achievement. And, of course, they gave me a voucher to spend at the bookshop. So what did I do? I went and bought the textbook. And that was actually a textbook that I used at first year in university in undergraduate geology. So it was at that level. So, of course, the millions of years are there in that textbook. And, of course, I'm regularly attending church and Bible class. It was a great time because we had in our church older folks, and I mean older folks, people in their 60s and 70s, who really had a heart for training young people. And we'd go through the scriptures and very thoroughly grounded in the scriptures. And so the issues immediately came into sharp focus for me. And my mother and my parents were both quite concerned about this. The view that was held in the church, because the church used the Scofield Bible, was, of course, the gap theory. And that just didn't seem to satisfy me. So my mother went along to a Christian bookstore in Sydney, where there was an elderly gentleman who owned the bookstore, told him what I was doing and what the dilemma was. And he says, look, this is the book he has to read, The Genesis Flood.
What year was that, Andrew?
That would have been That would have been about 1970, 1972, early high school.
It's just fascinating because The Genesis Flood was the first major book that
yes.
I was able to get hold of,
and
too.
It's true with so many. I keep on meeting people. That was the book that was a watershed for so many, either in turning them to a correct understanding of the script, of the science from a biblical perspective, or in some cases, you know, challenging the claims of Scripture so that they became Christians. So I read that book in my teenage years, and so I very quickly became convinced because I had that biblical foundation. What is so critical is the fact for me, for everyone, but why I was able to make these steps was because I had that thorough grounding in the Scriptures. So many people sort of come from a position, in a sense, of faith in science, trying to marry the Scriptures, whereas I was coming from the other direction. I had that thorough grounding and training in the Scriptures and was endeavouring to see how the science fitted the Scriptures. And I think that's a crucial difference. Why by the time I finished high school, I was convinced that this was an area, not only was going to be a geologist, that I was going to some form of telling people, particularly Christians, how the science fitted the Scriptures. And I had no knowledge. I had no knowledge of any other person. I thought I was, you know, sort of apart from having read the Genesis Flood, and then I went to the went to the Christian bookstores, and every time there was a new book from Henry Morris or a book on the subject, always from over here in the United States, not in Australia. So I thought I might be the only person in Australia who was thinking this way, but I was, you know, soaking up these books all the time, and it was sort of so hungry to get all the information.
You know, it's very interesting because my background's very, very similar, how the Lord gave me a real burden for getting those books. And what year did you say you think you bought the Genesis Flood again?
It would have been about 1970.
I believe I obtained it in 74 or around about then.
Mm-hmm.
And the Genesis Flood had a great effect on my life, and it gave you a lot of answers at that time. And
that's
it's interesting
right.
how the Lord gave us both a real burden for getting materials.
That's right.
And then at some stage, you and I met up together too,
yes,
didn't we?
Well, when I finished my undergraduate training at the University of New South Wales and graduated, I had a choice. I obtained first class honours, which for a thesis, which is a bit like a mini master's thesis here in the US, and first class honours is a top award, and you can in Australia go straight from that level of degree into a PhD program. You don't have to sit for do a master's in between. And I had an offer. I had an offer of a job with a mining company because in the summers, I had the summer vacations. I'd been working with a mining company because one of the professors that I studied under, I had been at school with his son and played cricket with his son, and he was a cricket fanatic. And so he more or less took me under his wing, and he helped me get this summer vacation training, which was very good. It was very practical, and I learned a lot. But so I had the choice of working for this mining company or doing a PhD. And as I shared with a number of people, Christian folk at the church, pastor, and also one of the science teachers I had at high school was a Christian, but he was a theistic evolutionist. But he was still very supportive. And the thing that came through as I shared with people, I said, look, you know, I feel the Lord is calling me into eventually, you know, being full-time talking about these issues. As I said before, I had no idea at that stage that any such ministry existed. And people said to me, well, if you want to be heard and you want to, you know, be respected and people listen to you, really got to get a PhD. Because even though they mightn't agree with you, at least they've got to give you a hearing because you've got that qualification. So I elected to take the PhD, and that was at the University of Sydney in 1975. At the beginning of that year, in the middle of that year, the Bible Union of Australia had Dr. Duane Gish come to Australia on a speaking tour, and he came to the University of it was late July, and I've still got the flyer advertising the meeting. And so I went along to the meeting to hear Dwayne, and I vividly remember talking to him on the lawn outside the lecture theatre after the presentation. There was a number of us talking with him, and of course he told me about ICR. He told me about Dr. Henry Morris, and of course I had a letter from Dr. Henry Morris soon after that, and I wrote back to him. So that was the first idea that I had that there was anyone else around in this sort of ministry. And it wasn't long after that that the pastor at the time in our church had involvement with a Christian magazine, and he asked me to write an article on the indicators of a young earth. It was only a short one-page article. Within a few days of that article going to press, I had a phone call from a medical doctor over the other side of Sydney, Dr. Phil West, and he said, "Oh, it's great to know there's someone else around the place who's talking about these issues." At the same time, that same pastor gave me some literature about a magazine that had started in Adelaide, Ex Nihilo, and also told me about the
Creation Science Educational Media Services.
Yeah, that's right. All right. With a guy called Ken Ham and John Mackay were sort of setting up in Brisbane. And so that's how I first had contact with Ken. And then when he came to Sydney, the Bible Union of Australia, I think we met, that's right, we met in Phil West's home. And also when the Bible Union of Australia had, I think it was Lane Lester and Harold Slusher come out, Ken came down and John came down with books. And I think we had one of the guys stay in our home. By that time I was married, and they stayed in our home near the university. So, you know, we got off to a flying start. That was in the late 1970s in Australia. And, you know, even at that stage when I was doing my PhD, it was quite clear in my conversations with Ken that, and he knew that I was heading in the direction of full-time creation ministry eventually, as the Lord would enable, you know, and make it possible.
While you're doing your PhD now, is it actually, what do you call it, PhD in what sort of geology?
It's a PhD in geology. I was working on in what we call hard rock geology. What I was looking at was a uranium deposit in the Northern Territory of Australia, 200 miles east of Darwin. It's a high-grade uranium ore vein in metamorphic rocks, rocks that are supposedly old and been affected by pressure and temperature. And the object of the study was to describe the deposit and its geology, how the uranium minerals occurred, and posit some ideas, propose some ideas as to how the uranium accumulated there. So that the object is, if you can work out how the uranium accumulated and how indicators that it, as to why it's there and not somewhere else, it helps mining companies find new deposits. That project is now in the middle of a national park, and it still hasn't been mined. But so I did the PhD thesis on that, the mineralogy and geochemistry of the Coongara uranium deposit in the Northern Territory of Australia.
Didn't you write an article at some stage for Creation Ex Nihilo magazine a long time ago?
Yes.
On that?
Very soon after I'd finished, my scholarship finished, and so I had a little bit of writing up still to do of my dissertation. So I got permission from the university to leave and take a job with a mining company up in Darwin, and they were interested in having my expertise because they were exploring for uranium deposits. And I finished writing the thesis up and submitted it from working up in the Northern Territory, based in Darwin. But I'd come across others who had done work on the project, on that deposit and other deposits, uranium deposits in that area. They'd done some dating work where they'd taken the major uranium mineral, which is uranium oxide, and they had used the uranium dating method, uranium thorium lead dating method on it. And they'd published the results, and to me it was quite obvious that they were selective in what they'd published, or they hadn't made it clear that they had some rather strange results, like three of the five samples from the uranium deposit that I was studying gave a zero age. And of course, they didn't emphasize that. Also, the ages were very variable and
they were selective in what they published.
Yeah, they were selective. And so I wrote an article for Creation Magazine and that caused a furor because these guys, one of the guys who authored the article, the original article in a prestigious international journal, was one of the staff at the Australian National University where the analyses were done. And actually, he was, I don't know whether he's still around now, but he attended church, I found out. He was a Church of England attender, and he got rather irate. And I understand, I was told later, that he was part of a delegation that went to the professor at the university, the professor of the geology department, who was saying, you know,
at the University of Sydney.
At the University of Sydney, and said, this is not good enough. We can't have one of your students with a PhD, you know, writing this kind of thing. And I was told, I didn't know at the time, but I was told subsequently by my supervisor that they were asking that my PhD be taken from me for having written this article, which essentially was not untruthful in the slightest. All I was doing was pointing out the problems with the dating methods from their own results.
In other words,
showing how they were selected.
You exposed some data that they didn't publish.
Exactly. In fact, with the thorium analyses, and thorium-lead dates are normally regarded as more reliable because thorium dust is not as susceptible to being dissolved by groundwaters. And there was lots of evidence in this uranium deposit that groundwaters had leached uranium. Because in the weathered zone, there was new deposition of uranium minerals. And so that's why the uranium dates were unreliable. And the thorium dates, which are supposed to be more reliable, gave very young ages, including zero ages. And of course, they didn't like that being pointed out. And of course, it was consistent with a biblical perspective for the age of the earth.
So do you think, now, could they have actually taken your PhD away from you?
No, not directly in that means, because it's the PhD thesis is awarded under the authority of the university governing body called the University Senate under the Australian system. And the professor would have had to have taken it, and there would have to have been hearings and all that kind of thing. And so I think he laughed it off. But an even more serious threat came in the 1990s. At the time, we had a major attack on the ministry in Australia. And of course, I'm jumping over a lot of history there, because after working 4.5 years in the mining industry, Ken invited me to join the staff in Brisbane, and so I moved to Brisbane in late 1983, and I was working with Ken for three years before we exported him here to the United States. But it was in the 90s, early 90s, we had a major attack on the ministry in Australia from a geology professor. He was at the University of Newcastle, and then he moved to the University of Melbourne. And it was Ian Plimer. He wrote a book accusing us of telling lies for God. And I was one of the major targets. Well, I found out that he and others, prior to writing that book, or at the time they wrote that book, they actually approached the university senate itself, the governing body of the university, to have my PhD taken away from me. And, of course, because of the controversy it would have stirred up, the university senate, I was told that it was just dismissed out of hand and not taken any further.
Didn't somebody at that start, I remember somebody making a statement they didn't want another Galileo affair or something?
Yes, to that effect, that's right.
Did you know who made that statement?
No, I don't.
I heard somebody did make it.
Yes. The only way I got the information was via my former supervisor, who I'd kept in contact with, and he didn't live too far from my parents. And so I had contact with him over the years for quite a while.
You know, what's interesting, Andrew, is, I mean, you're going back to the 1990s and then back to the 1970s with, you know, attacks on you as a creationist having a PhD from a reputable, you know, secular university.
Right.
And today, in the 21st century, the creation evolution issue has heated up so much more. Can you imagine what it would be like today trying to get a PhD if you're a creationist?
It is. It's obviously going to be harder and harder for students to fly the flag before they get their PhDs. When I had that meeting, when I first met Duane Gish in 1975, I was in my first year of my PhD program, and I was talking to Duane Gish on the lawn outside the lecture theatre. It happened to be, I was seen from the geology building, because the geology building was the other side of the lawn. Within an hour, I was called by my supervisor to have, come and have a chat, and he said to me, in effect, I don't buy into this issue. You're obviously free to believe as you will, and I'm happy to have you as a student. It's not a problem to me if you want to believe that way, because obviously he understood what he had heard what Duane was talking about, and obviously I was sympathetic in their eyes. But he said, look, if you want to get a PhD around here, you better keep quiet. Let's keep it between ourselves, and you better not say anything. I mean, he was merely giving me his advice that if I wanted to get my PhD, I'd have to keep my mouth shut. Otherwise, the powers that be would take a dim view of me being a creationist.
So in other words, it didn't matter how good your science was, it didn't matter how well you passed your exams.
That's correct.
You can be the best student in the world.
That's
but if you're
correct.
A creationist,
that's right.
You can't get a PhD.
That's right. That in effect. And that was, you're talking about the mid to late 1970s. And so if that was the case then, it's doubly impossible for a young person anywhere in the Western world, I would think, particularly in Australia, in Britain, here in the US, to be known as a creationist while you're doing your graduate studies is suicidal. You'll never get it. They'll find some excuse to, you know, they'll try to cover it and not make it discriminatory, but they'll find some way of working it that you get the bad end of the stick, so that you don't get your...
You know what's interesting, Andrew? We have someone who's a PhD who writes for us right now, but they have to do it as a pen name and not tell people where they're from because of the consequences.
That was the same with Steve Austin in the late 70s.
Yeah,
he had to be known as Stuart Nevins.
Yeah, Dr. Steve Austin from the Institute for Creation Research. He's a well-known creationist geologist. He wrote under a pen name. Also, Dr. Jason Lyle, who has a PhD in astrophysics with us, he has written for us under a pen name while he was getting his PhD. Now, I remember when you were working up there in Coongara, you and your wife, Kim, were one of our best financial supporters. There was a check arrived every month, if I remember, for support at what was then known as the Creation Science Foundation.
Yeah, well, we moved to Darwin in May 1979, and you went full-time about August, wasn't it? September.
And you started sending finances in to help us
with that. That's right, exactly.
You're one of the first major financial contributors.
I guess we're a foundation supporter.
Yeah.
So, hey, look what the Lord's done with that money here.
And you used to send that support in for Ken, and label for Ken and John Malley. Mackay, I think, wasn't it? Ken and Malley at first, and then later on for Ken
That's
and John
right.
Mackay. Send that you and Kim sent that support in on a regular basis. It always came regularly. I'll never forget that. And then you came and worked full time for us.
That's right.
Then we had to find others to support so
That's
we could
right.
pay your salary.
That's right. That's the way it works.
And you worked.
Pass the blessings on.
Worked in the Creation Science Foundation. Then I came to America and you continued on working in the Creation Science Foundation. And then you moved to work with the Institute for Creation Research.
That's
what
right.
year was that?
That was the end of 1998.
1998. And with the Institute for Creation Research, you're basically a geology researcher
and
writer. And weren't you responsible primarily for the research on what's called the RATE project?
What happened in 1997, an initiative started at ICR. One of the board members evidently raised at a board meeting that ICR and the creation movement generally wasn't really tackling head-on the issue of the dating of rocks and the millions of years, which of course is so foundational to the whole evolutionary edifice. Without the millions of years, there's no time for biological evolution. And so Dr. Larry Vardaman took up the challenge and decided to invite a group of creationist researchers, physicists, geologists, to be a think tank and a research group. And so the first meeting was actually held on July, of all days, July 4, 1997. And I'd been over here on a speaking for Ken here, and I'd flown back to Australia. I had to fly back here a week later for that meeting at ICR in San Diego. And we first of all, began talking about, we each had to talk about what we saw as the problems or where we saw how this issue might be resolved. Now, I'd already started research when I was working with Answers in Genesis in Australia, as it had become known by then. I'd already been to New Zealand when we had a summer camp in New Zealand and had collected samples from historical lava flows at Mount Narahoe in the central island of the central North Island of New Zealand, because the camp was not far. The camp we ran, the campsite was not very far away, and so I had collected samples, which I of course had already started sending away for potassium argon analyses.
And when were those lava flows supposed to have occurred?
The lava flows were 1949, 1954. And 1975, the ones that I sampled, and actually, you knew the day and the month,
right?
So you actually knew exactly.
And when you dated
them, like the 30th of June 1954 flow, gave a potassium argon age of 3.5 million years, and so I already had some results that I had started talking about before I went to that research meeting at ICR.
Now, didn't you write that up in an article too?
Is that
on their website or Creation Magazine?
There's an article in Creation Magazine. There was also a 1998 ICC article.
ICC, and 1998.
They'll all be on file and also on websites.
Right.
Available on websites. Also, early in the 1990s, I'd also... Because what we used to do is we used to combine our ministry trips wherever we were. We'd look for research opportunities. And Ken had already been, for example, when he'd been in Britain, he'd been past this quarry where there was fossil wood alongside of ammonite fossils and supposedly 180 million years old. And so I collected wood samples. I had other wood samples. I was alerted to a developing coal mine in central Queensland, where they to dig down to get to the coal bed, they had gone through a basalt layer, and inside the basalt layer was the basalt lava flow. There was some fossil wood, and so I had these fossil wood samples from different locations where they were supposed to be millions of years old, and I sent them to a carbon-14 labs, radiocarbon labs, because on the basis of our biblical viewpoint, these would be fossil woods from either before or soon after the flood. They were obviously only thousands of years old, and they ought to be radiocarbon in them. Whereas the conventional scientific community would say that those fossil woods, being in strata that are millions and millions of years old, there would be no radiocarbon in them. So I submitted them to the labs without telling them where they came from, even though the submission forms asked you where they came from. You know, it's like, you know, tell me what you think the age is and we'll match it, sort of thing. That's the kind of, you know, but although they do have to calibrate their instruments and be careful, but in every instance, those fossil wood samples came back with genuine radiocarbon ages. They were in there. Now, all those have been written up in Creation Magazine.
But that means it can't be millions of years old.
No.
But what about
no.
the claim of contamination?
Well, we covered that because I asked them to also do what we call the carbon isotope ratios. Carbon comes in three forms: carbon-12, which is normal carbon; carbon-13, which is a normal, but there's only a small proportion of it in irregular carbon; and then the radioactive carbon-14. And so when you get a carbon-14 analysis, if you also ask them to check for carbon-13 and carbon-12 to get the ratio of the two, that is the ratio is characteristic of the type of material that you're looking at. And so I had that done, and it fell, of course, where it should, right in the field of wood, which meant that it was the carbon-14 was coming from wood, not from outside contamination. In any case, the laboratory procedures they use in preparing the samples remove a lot of the contamination and remove any. They're very careful about doing that. And I mean, we could go on. It's another story with the rate research when we looked at radiocarbon in the literature for two decades. They've been arguing about the radiocarbon that they've been finding in ancient materials and been calling it contamination, but now they realise that it's not. But they're not prepared to look into the implications of that. But
the implications are the millions of years are out the window.
That's exactly right. So we could jump ahead on that, but we won't. We'll go back historically. So I'd already started some research, and that's why I was asked to join the group. So AIG had been sponsoring and supporting me doing research at that time. And the reason, of course, is that my philosophy has always been that research is fundamental because it provides new information, obviously, searching for answers that people are asking. We're finding answers to the questions that people are asking to show them that the evidence supports God's word. And once we obtain the information, then it doesn't do anyone any good if it sits in a filing cabinet. So that the ultimate objective is to publish it, whether it be in a technical venue or usually you do a technical version and you do a layman's version, so it's translated for the, and so that speakers can then use the information. And I know Ken has used some of this information in his lectures over the years, and that's important. That's important for Ken and others to be able to do that. They can't do the research, but those who can are able to do it and then provide the information. So we're already doing that, and that's why I was invited to join this group in 1997. The great strategy of that group was in the first few years we talked and talked and talked about what the present state of play was and what we could do about it, what kind of research that we could do. Previously, people had tried to do this thing on a one-on-one basis, alone. And the powerfulness of the group was the fact that here was guys who were praying together, talking together, seeking counsel, you know, iron sharpens iron, the biblical principle of multiplicity of counselors. And I think that's what really kept us on track, the fact that we were able to support one another because we're dealing with a strategic issue and Satan would attack. There was no question. He had attacked in the past, and there were people who had investigated these issues and been supposedly overwhelmed by the supposed evidence for old ages that they'd sort of abandoned ship, so to speak, and gone off spiritually.
Do you think the RATE project answered the questions about the dating methods, about the problems, about the issues?
I believe it gave significant results that give answers and confidence to Christians. I mean, there's more that could always be done, and there's more that will be done. But there is sufficient there to show that these methods are unreliable and that there is contrary evidence to show that the Earth is young from radioisotopes.
Is one of those positive evidences the carbon-14
yes,
in diamonds?
Yes, the radiocarbon, yes. In the diamonds was quite a surprise because no one had ever attempted that before to look for radiocarbon in diamonds. And these diamonds that we had sent to the lab normally regarded as 1 to 3 billion years old, so they're sort of intrinsic to the early Earth. And they've only come to the Earth's surface recently. Diamond is extremely hard and it's not subject to contamination. And the initial methodology for analysing these diamonds was to follow the normal way of combusting, burning the diamonds to turn them into carbon dioxide and then turn that back into graphite for putting in the machine for measuring. Just recently, because of someone else we heard who has done diamond analysis subsequent to what we've done, we've actually had the diamonds directly put in the sample into the machine so that you eliminate those steps where you could get contamination, and we've duplicated the results. And this is, we're talking about radiocarbon levels which are above the detection limit, well above the detection limits of the equipment involved. So it's not a question.
So how old does the radiocarbon say they are?
The radiocarbon, using the normal assumptions of conventional science.
And I emphasize we have problems with those.
Yeah, exactly. I emphasize that. It comes in about 55 to 60,000 years. But that's assuming that radiocarbon has always been produced at the present rate and there's always been the same radiocarbon levels.
Using their own secular methods.
Exactly. Yeah. But once you start to think about the flood and what happened in the flood and what radiocarbon was like before the flood, you can do some calculations to show that it's less than 10,000 years. That age comes right down.
One last question. And that is this. You know, when you look back on your life and you look at your training in school and then the influence, the Genesis flood, a significant event in your life, as mm-hmm. it was in mine, mm-hmm. the book that Dr. Henry Morris, Dr. Wickham co-authored, because we're talking about this in the same year that Dr. Henry Morris went to be with the Lord too. Mm. And that book was published in 1961. Now, you are doing something very special at the present time as a project as part of the Institute for Creation Research. You are actually writing a new book on the flood that'll sort of replace the Genesis flood.
Well, I don't know whether it will ever replace it in terms of being a historical document and
to have an updated book on the flood.
Yes. I actually had the privilege of being asked in the early 90s to work on this project, but it never really happened because of all the other things I was doing. But when I came to ICR at the end of 1998, that was a major thing I was asked to do because no one had really taken the bull by the horn, so to speak, and taken this project on. And so it's something I've been working on now for the last 7 years, sort of detoured a little bit with the rate research, but it's currently at the stage where I'm in the last phases of producing a first draft of the whole manuscript. So I hope by the end of the northern summer, your summer here in the US, to deliver to ICR a full first manuscript. And when I say a full first manuscript, that means I've done editing and all sorts of things. So it's, in other people's terminology, it's probably at a more advanced stage.
So it'll be mainly dealing with the scientific aspects of the Genesis.
Well, both the biblical and the scientific aspects, just as the first book did, because again, we start with the scriptures. I'm very strong on that issue. We don't start with the science. So the book starts with a biblical defense of a defense of the biblical account of the flood, and then once the book aims to that, once that's established in the reader's minds, then we look at the science, which is the way it ought to be, because science is a finite, fallible human activity, but we're talking about God's word, the Creator God, and therefore He's told us what happened, and we build our science on that, and so the book will take that position, and we'll incorporate in it some of the latest findings from creationist scientists talking about the deposition during the flood of the layers and the fossils and earth movements, and of course deal briefly with the dating methods of the rocks. And of course those things, some of those evidences Dr. Henry Morris didn't have back in 1961.
And some of what's in the Genesis flood now we would leave out. It was the knowledge of the time.
That's right. Well, we're built on it. I think a lot of the basics were there.
Right.
Some things haven't changed all that very much.
But some things need fine-tuning.
Yes, that's right. And we've got so much more evidence. Right. I mean, Dr. Henry Morris took a stand, and many people, the Lord used that book to convict many people on the basis of that evidence. So how much more evidence we have now ought to be make this so much more powerful in convincing people.
Exactly. One last thing. So you hear it, Answers in Genesis in the USA, in Northern Kentucky, and you've had a little tour through the museum construction project. So what do you think about it?
Well, I had an inkling, of course, from all the correspondence and everything. So I knew a little bit of the scale of what was happening here. But, of course, you don't get the full effect of it and to actually walk through it and see the scale. And, you know, it's really mind-blowing what the Lord is doing in that sense. And I put the credit where it should be, is the Lord has raised up a team of so many able people. He's provided supporters to give the donations. And we're looking at, with all that I've seen, with the animatronics and the robotics and everything, you're talking about state of the art that would be the same class as any world class museum. And that's the way it ought to be. Why shouldn't God's people have the best technology to honour the Lord? Because the museum is dedicated to the glory of God, so anything substandard is not to the glory of God. And the level of expertise and the standard that's being strived for is God-honouring, and it's really, really heartwarming and thrilling to anyone who wants to come and see it. It's going to be a great time when it opens next year. And what a witness. I mean, it's designed, it's essentially designed not only to give glory to the Creator, but to present the gospel message, which is the heart of everything that we do. I mean, that's why we're here. We're not doing all this as a matter of science, as an objective in itself. The heart of the matter is we want to see people come to know the Saviour, to know the Creator. And so the heart of the museum is a gospel presentation, and that's special, and that's the way it ought to be. Everything's periphery around that and pointing in that direction, and that's what's really God-honoring about this whole project.